Warren Olney back with today's talking point. Age of Ambition is subtitled Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. Evan Osnos divides his book according to those broad themes. He is a lifelong student of China, speaks Mandarin Chinese, lived in China as a foreign correspondent from 2005 to 2013, and since 2008, he's been a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He's here in her studio, and it's a delight to have you with us. It's a wonderful book, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Warren. Thanks for having me in.
Let's start with the fortune. The very idea of fortune, it seems to me, was forbidden by Mao Zedong. How do they readjust to the idea that it's time to seek fortune?
Yeah, if you think about it, it's this extraordinary turnaround in human history. For the first 30 years after the Communist Revolution in 1949, if you even talked about the idea of starting a business, that was political suicide, and it really would ruin people's lives. And then a generation ago, in 1979, the government said socialist economics are not working for us, and they put them aside and they held on to the Communist Party as a political organization, and they said, all right, it's now up to you as an individual citizen in this country to figure out a way to get rich. The way Deng Xiaoping put it was, let one group of people get rich first and then everybody else will follow.
How long did it take Chinese people to adjust to what was certainly a revolution in the way they were supposed to think?
It really was mind-boggling. The term people use in Chinese is songbang, which is literally the verb to unleash a prisoner or an animal that's been tied up. That's how fundamental it felt in people's lives. And you have to imagine what it wasn't just choice in your economic life. It rippled through your life in all kinds of ways. So all of a sudden, people who had never had control over, for instance, who they married, all of a sudden that was opened up and people were able to figure out, okay, I don't just want to marry somebody from the village. I want to go out and find this person who suits what it is that I'm looking for in the world. So there was this huge range of individual choice and autonomy that suddenly flooded into people's lives.
One of the people that you talk about who became a plutocrat as a result of all of this started a dating service online. Tell us about her, where she came from, how her thinking led her to even think about that, let alone do it.
Yeah, she's an interesting case. Her name is Gong Haiyan. I met her when she was in graduate school. And, you know, she'd grown up in a village. Her parents couldn't read or write. They were farmers. And she realized early on she was getting an education, a terrific education, much like a lot of the people of this generation who have grown up in this period of relative peace and prosperity. So she's in Beijing getting this great graduate degree. And then she realized, but the only people my parents can introduce me to are people who come from their world. And so I need to figure out a way to meet somebody who's right for me. She started basically the Chinese Match.com. And by the time I left China, she had made $77 million bringing it public on the New York Stock Exchange. And that kind of story, that sort of warp speed transformation in people's individual biographies is a hallmark of this period in China.
Describe the place where she lives now.
What was interesting about it was that she lives in this villa out in the suburbs, and which is a gorgeous place. And in some ways, though, her life has moved too fast for her own habits and her own sort of ways of thinking can catch up. So, for instance, when I came to have dinner one night, I noticed that the family motorbike was in the front hall of their family house. I said, well, why is it inside? And she said, well, it's not safe to leave it outside. I said, I think you're okay. Your next-door ambassador is the Swiss ambassador. I mean, the next-door neighbor is the Swiss ambassador. I think you'll be okay. So, you know, in a way, all of China in one form or another is going through this kind of growth spurt overnight. But the tension comes in when people's economic and social lives have transformed, but in some ways their political lives have stayed stagnant.
Sounds like the Beverly Hillbillies.
Yeah, it does feel that way sometimes.
You talk about individual consumerism gone wild. Tell us about that when consumerism, once again, under Mao Zedong, is something that you probably didn't talk about.
Yeah, over the course of the time I was living there, for instance, China became the world's leading consumer of things like BMWs and Land Rovers and you go down the list, Louis Vuitton, all of them now make a huge part of their money from luxury buyers in China. And part of that's because for so long people had no way of showing their success. And of course, it was banned. But one of the things that's been really fascinating over the last few years is to see that people who have now made it, they've got the money, they've shown all their neighbors and their friends that they've got that money. Now they're starting to move into other more complicated questions about, for instance, well, what do I stand for as a person? What do I believe in? What's my moral code? And so there's this sort of accelerated process of moving through materialism, consumerism, and into something deeper.
One of the fascinating things you talk about, too, is their view of the West. And one of the ways in which you found out about that was to go on a tour.
Yeah, I signed up for a tour of Europe with Chinese tourists, and it was 10 days on a bus across 5 countries with 39 tourists and me, and they were incredibly welcoming, I should say. I was very grateful for that. But you discovered a few things. One, it turns out it is possible to cross Europe for 10 days and never eat anything but Chinese food. And in a way,
very good Chinese food, according to your companions on the bus.
They didn't have very high marks for it. But, you know, in a way, that felt, for me as an American, that felt kind of familiar, because how many Americans have gone to Europe in search of a hamburger, ultimately? Yeah. And I kind of sympathized with the experience of being new to this forbidding outside world. And after all, none of them had ever been outside of Asia before. And so they went around, and in some ways they were quite impressed with things they saw. Most of all, they were impressed with the education system in the West. And I think that's one of the things that comes through, is that when Chinese people look at the United States, there's a lot that baffles them, particularly right now about our political system and how we work or don't work in Washington. But when they look at our educational institutions, that's what they admire.
Let's go back to how it was that the Communist Party was able, to put this across and survive as a powerful institution. And in the truth section of the book, you talk about the Central Publicity Department, a big building that doesn't have a name on it.
Yeah, the Central Publicity Department became a source of endless fascination for me, because I should say that its English name is Central Publicity Department. Its Chinese name is the Central Propaganda Department. And it's a very powerful institution in China. It's in charge of everything for instance, it's in charge of not only what goes on the front page of the newspaper, but also which professors can be hired and fired at universities and the kinds of words that can be used in academic publications. So, for instance, a few years ago, the Central Propaganda Department said that the word totalitarianism is no longer usable when discussions of Chinese history are published. So all of a sudden that word disappeared. And, you know, that's a big fact in terms of understanding what it feels like to be Chinese, is that there is this sense right now in 2014 that even though you've got control over your shopping habits and your marriage habits and your travel habits, that there is this Central Propaganda Department, which is a giant building in downtown Beijing that has no sign, it has no address, and it appears nowhere on organizational charts of the party, because the party really doesn't want to talk about the propaganda system.
And one of the things they don't want to talk about is what happened in Tiananmen Square. I understand there's a generation of Chinese that simply doesn't know about it.
Yeah, they know about a little bit. They know something happened. I think sometimes we imagine that it's just this blank spot in their understanding. And actually, it's a little bit more it's more interesting. In fact, what they know is that there was, as it's often described in Chinese history, turmoil. There was a disturbance. And what they've been taught in school is that had those events not turned out, had they turned out differently, had there not been a crackdown by the military, that China's economic gains would have been impossible. And that's the message they've been taught. And what you're seeing these days, as we get ready to mark 25 years since that crackdown at Tiananmen Square, is that there is a conversation going on. You know, it's below the radar, it's among people at their dinner tables, but there's a conversation going on about just what happened in 1989, and have we reconciled ourselves with what happened in this country?
Well, one of the things you talk about, too, is the adjustment to the internet and how difficult that has made it for the propaganda department to enforce its will. Obviously, things are going to be as different in China, you know, 20 years from now as they are now from the way things were 20 years ago. The book is once again called The Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in New China. Evan Osnos is the author. Wish we had more time to talk about it, but thanks a lot for being on our program today.
Thanks, Warren.